Welcome to the English with Kirsty podcast from www.englishwithkirsty.com. Here I'll be sharing with you tips, information and other learning resources so that you can improve your business English. Welcome back to the English with Kirsty podcast. I have a slightly different episode today, but it still fits in with all the topics that we usually talk about because this podcast is about communication, effective communication, and also that means accessible communication. And so my guest here was originally going to be part of another episode, which I am planning and will bring to you in the next few weeks on audio description. But when I discovered that she does a lot of other things as well, I thought it would be good to have a one-to-one discussion with her so we can explore that a bit more. So welcome. Welcome, Joan. It's nice that you're here. Thank you for agreeing to be on the podcast.
And thank you. Yeah, thank you so much, Kirsty. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, it's great. I think we're going to have a good conversation. Do you want to start by introducing yourself and saying something about who you are and what you do, and then we'll go into more of the details?
Absolutely. So thank you again, Kirsty. I am Gisele Yaneves, the Portuguese way to say my name. Internationally, usually it's easier just to call me Josilia, or as I prefer, Jo. Who am I? Well, I always see myself as an educator, first and foremost. I am a teacher of communication strategies for inclusion. Originally a teacher of audiovisual translation, then I specialized in subtitling for deaf and hard of hearing audiences, audio description for blind and vision impaired audiences in multiple contexts, the media, culture in general, museums, live performances. So that's where it all began. At this stage, I've moved away slightly from the disability-centered solution to a problem approach where everything began, to look at communication as only happening if it is fully accessible. While I started off as a teacher of audiovisual translation, I now focus on accessibility, lato sensu, because I believe that all communication needs to be accessible, and not only should we be focusing on solutions for persons with disability, but rather on proposing forms of communicating that are encompassing. Further than my teaching occupations, I see myself also as a researcher. My research interests are clearly linked to my teaching. And I also see myself as a social entrepreneur, because I believe that all three of these areas need to talk to each other and come very closely linked if we want to impact society and promote social change. So that's who I am in a nutshell.
That's a lot. There's a lot to unpack there. And I think it's interesting what you were saying. I'm maybe not as familiar with the history of how things have developed in terms of accessible communication, but I do think it's really important to give people choices. And I think in the past, assumptions have been made about what people's needs are based on one thing that is known about them. But as individuals, we are complex. We have needs that sometimes change from day to day, but also that other needs that people may not be aware about. So giving people the choice and a range of ways in which they can access the information means that you are automatically making communication more accessible, but at the same time, taking away some of the need for people to express what what their needs are, because I've been in educational settings where other learners have benefited from, for example, materials that were created for people with disabilities, but actually some of the other learners found them much easier to use and found the information much better for them to be able to learn. So I think providing choices for everybody gives benefits a lot more people than you may initially set out to, and gives
Absolutely,
people more
Kirsty.
choice.
Absolutely. I think you have picked up the main idea. It's about giving people choice. It's about allowing people to be in the center of the Communication Act. It's about also flattening this notion that there are those who can and those who can't. And as well, it also removes the need for mediation. If communication starts off as being intrinsically accessible, then we will not be needing to call in a translator or a mediator to solve a problem and to remove a barrier that was initially there. So, when I teach, when I talk about accessible communication, I always say we can go about it in two different ways. Either we think about accessibility before we start communicating, and we make sure that the way we communicate is useful and complete. In view of the possible audiences or interlocutors we will be communicating with, and that is taking a proactive approach to accessibility, or we can just go about communicating without thinking of who our interlocutors are going to be, and we will be failing in our communication. And because we become aware of that failure, of that barrier, of that noise in the communication, we have to call in somebody to solve the problem. And that's where the translator comes in, and that's where communication is no longer natural and no longer equitable, because the other person who we are communicating with has failed to pick up what we want to communicate. Not because there is something wrong with them, but there is something wrong with the strategies that the communicator enacted right from the beginning. So it's quite a term in the way we look at accessibility and in the way we address communication as either fully accessible right from the start or simply communication that may need an extra solution to support it, to guarantee that everybody can come and go between this broken telephone that needs something else to make it work.
So ideally, the first way is best, but in terms of the projects in which you're involved, do you do both? Do you go in afterwards when people realize that they have a need and assist them with that, or do you focus primarily on the projects where accessible information is built in from the start, the communication strategy is there at the beginning?
I'd like to believe that we are now living in a changing environment. Initially, accessibility was always seen as an afterthought. So most of the projects that I've been involved in so far have been back to front, in the sense that people come to me requesting for a solution as an add-on to something that they had initially thought of without providing all the possible ways by which to communicate. So indeed, most of my projects are still living from the afterthought. However, both through the educational process that we've been going about in the last 2, 3 years, and also thanks to European legislation or even global, if we think about the WCAG, where websites are now required to comply with the basic characteristics of a fully accessible communication act. People are beginning to think about incorporating accessibility solutions from inception, from the start. And if we are just to move a little fast forward, this year I would see as an incredible leap if the European Accessibility Act is truly taken forward and enacted. Because the moment that we have laws and regulations to comply by, we will find that companies, institutions will start thinking about accessibility in a proactive manner. Because I would believe that communities, people are not aware of how useful these solutions are and how much the economic impact of having this proactive approach. If a website is fully accessible, anybody, regardless of their profile, will be able to interact with that information. If I am selling a product and my product is pitched in such a way that a blind person, a deaf person, somebody with intellectual disability, neurodivergence, an immigrant, somebody with a lower income, somebody with a different culture, if my website has taken all those parameters into account and has styled its information in such a way that it speaks to each of these different profiles, then I am bound to sell more, to get my idea across better, and therefore to make monetary or social profit out of this proactive approach. So I truly believe that in the very near future, the paradigm will shift and we will not look at accessibility as an add-on, but rather as a natural component of effective communication at a global level.
Yeah, and I
Makes
think
sense.
before you, yeah, I think before you look at the benefits, that people also have to appreciate what the problems are. When I think about my own experience, I do most of my shopping online, to be honest, but my frustrations with inaccessible websites definitely shape my choices. That they do make me a more loyal customer, to be fair, because if I find a website that has taken accessibility requirements into consideration, I will go back because it's not what I'm going to find everywhere. It's something that I appreciate, but unfortunately, it's not the norm. So I think a lot of the time, people don't realize when people are clicking away from their websites or not participating in their events because maybe even the sign-up process wasn't accessible. I don't think people are always necessarily aware of the problems because every time. For me, when I have this kind of situation, I don't then have time to contact them and say, "Oh, do you know your website isn't accessible?" Because I need to buy a birthday present or I need to get something done. So my focus is on buying the product that I want to buy and finding someone that does have an accessible website. And I don't think people are necessarily aware of the barriers that they create through not considering other people's requirements. And I was wondering if we could move to a more practical, to help people to gain a better understanding who may not have considered these topics before. Perhaps you could explain some of the practical ways in which you've helped to make events or museum visits or something like that a more accessible experience. So the kind of things that you did or that you needed to go in and do afterwards because people hadn't thought about them, but how you have worked with companies or organizations to make their events or exhibitions more accessible to everyone.
Absolutely. Let me give you as an example what happens with a museum, for instance. I'm very often called in, and I'm requested to write audio descriptive guides for museums. Museums approach me and they say, "We have this beautiful exhibition. People are not visiting us. We would like a more diverse public to come through the door. Would you write a audio guide that would suit not only the regular visitor but also a blind visitor?" By all means, I come along, I talk to the curators, I talk to the administrators, I look at the exhibition, and together, collaboratively, we arrive at which of those paintings, artworks, artifacts, rooms, installations are going to be described. Once we do that, we start working on the actual scripting. And then we record it. We find equipment that will support the audio descriptive guide or any guide that we have developed. And apparently, my job is done. I get paid and goodbye. But that's not the reality. Because that museum may have that absolutely fantastic mediation tool. But if people do not know about it, they will not be coming to that museum anyway, and they will not be using that tool. So usually what I do with museums that request any sort of mediation, I work with them on how to get people to actually use that tool. That material or that solution that they are offering. And to make sure that that piece of communication is truly useful, first and foremost, I need to train the front of house, the people working in the museum, on how to use the equipment, how to inform visitors about it, how to welcome visitors to their venue, how to interact with a person who may not be seeing or who does not hear, or depending on the profile of the user, obviously, we need to train the people at the venue to communicate effectively. And to help the visitor to use that service. But more than that, I help that museum to pitch and to market their offer. Is their website accessible? I create a need for that museum to reflect about its overall communication practices. How will a blind person coming to your website know that your museum is offering a fantastic audio guide? So I call this the Russian doll model. It's useless for a museum to pay hundreds for a new audio guide with audio description, or to get a touchable replica of its main artifact, but then not to have an overall communication strategy that will bring the public and the public with that particular profile, children or elders or blind visitors or whoever we are working for. That museum cannot only offer one service, but needs to encapsulate that service in a number of strategies to guarantee that that service is used. Does this help at all to see how the strategy is encased and holistic?
Yeah, because I think a lot of the time people think about individual like pieces of information. So you may have an audio guide, but as you say, it's the whole journey from finding out that this thing exists and being able to use it. I've come across audio guides. I mean, I do enjoy them, and I usually try to find one that isn't in English, that's in one of my other languages, so that I can also have like a language experience as well. But that's not the main point. But I found some have worked very well, and I do use them, but I've also found some very inappropriate hardware, for example, so that you have to, I mean, I use a touch screen on my phone, but that also has additional software, but you have to be able to see the screen in order to operate the audio guide, which is a problem in itself, because the audio guide may be really good, but if you're expecting somebody to use a piece of equipment that they can't use independently, then it breaks down there. Or that, as you said, if people aren't aware, if the staff aren't aware, they don't offer this, then it doesn't help. So it's the whole user experience, like the journey from finding out about your event or your exhibition to experiencing it, and the information being appropriate, the information being easy to access. It's not just having this information available, it's how people interact with each other and interact with the tool that they're using to get the information. It's the whole journey, and all of these parts need to fit together and work. Otherwise, all the other work that you've done could be for nothing if people can't enjoy or experience what you intended them to enjoy or experience.
Absolutely. It is about the full journey. And if any little part or piece in that journey breaks down, there will never be a full user experience. So it's about being sensitive to all the components that go into making any experience whole and comfortable and safe and respectful and mindful of each individual's needs. And those needs may always go beyond the fact that they may have a disability. I often use this example. A young mother who comes into that very same museum with a child in her arms, who may not even be blind, may want to use this audio guide to help her understand what is there, and to help her tell her children, give her children a better experience. So, as you said earlier on, what we are offering or what we are preparing for people who are blind will be useful for others. And just as you find it so difficult to manipulate your iPhone, this mother who has a child in her arms may also have difficulty in activating now stop 354. And where is that number? And where should I stand? And where is the sound coming from? And how do I stop? How do I go forward? Because this child is crying, this child wants attention. So it's being very mindful of the fact that every single individual has a number of requirements, and those need to be thought about. Comfort, ease of use, the quality, the tone, all these elements. It's a very complex way to think about how to give each person the experience he or she deserves to live. You mentioned the user experience design. I'm very much in favor slightly different approach, which is user-sensitive design, thinking about each person as an individual. I know that we cannot afford to have a one-to-one support system in places where we have thousands of people, but when we think about the solution, we should think that it's useless to go into universal design. There is no such thing as for all. At best, we can make communication more accessible for more people. But what we want is to provide flexible solutions that may be tailored, and that may be used by people autonomously and in very comfortable and even low profile ways, because there's no need for somebody to say, I need this. I simply want to use this. And it's there for me to use. So it's quite, there's a little twist in the way I think about it.
Yeah, and I think it's also important if you're going to do that to ask the questions, because you can't, obviously everyone has budgets, and it would be great if we could offer as many solutions as possible. And I know that there are budget restraints in terms of that, but I think it's good to really investigate the options that are available, because then it may be possible to offer more than one. For example, what you were saying about the mother with her child. I've been to a museum where you didn't have to activate anything because it was done by sensor. So if you move into the area where you would learn about a particular thing, then the information would start playing automatically. So that is good for people who can't see where they should, the number that they should be putting in. That's also good for somebody carrying a child. Not so good if you want to manipulate the audio, go back and listen to something again, or check what did they say. You can't have as much of an interaction with it in that way, but you can at least not worry about that. You don't have to activate it. Whereas other staying on the museum example, I am aware of others that say, okay, well, you can use your own phone, you can use your own. We have an app, and you can, as long as that's accessible, because a lot of people have their screen readers set up. For example, mine speaks really quickly, but it's customized for them. And so if you aren't asking people to use additional hardware, then they're already using something that they know and are familiar with how to operate, and is probably a lot more accessible. Or you provide something completely different, but I know that people aren't going to be able to afford to offer all of these different things, but I guess it's choosing the one that is likely to offer the best experience to most
Absolutely.
people, and finding out what that is, because you never please everybody. That's the other thing. Everybody wants and needs different things, but I think you can only make an informed decision if you really are aware of all the options that are available to you.
Absolutely. And technology is, I would think, the least of our problems. I truly believe that solutions can be found at reasonably low cost, with reasonably low cost approaches. If we cannot afford to go high tech, let's make sure that we train our personnel to support the visitor with dignity, respect, and providing them what technology cannot do, which is an empathic one-to-one, collaborative, co-creative journey, and experience. Because most of cultural settings, what people go there for, more than to acquire knowledge, unless you are studying, you want to arrive at new information or gather new information. Most cultural experiences are about entertainment, social bonding, belonging to a community. And I think that can be achieved even without high tech, even without huge investment in tools. So it is, as you say, Kirsty, a matter of deciding where can I get the best output for the amount of money I can afford to put into this communication solution. But if money's not there, or if little money is there, I would say invest in training the people, because in the end, accessibility is about, or communication is about people coming together. And I really, I treasure that, and I put that in the very center of everything I do. Technology is usually in the periphery. Let's use what is out there. Let's choose what we can afford, what gives us the best outcome. But first and foremost, let's guarantee that communication is thought about in a very humanistic and close manner.
Okay, so these kinds of projects are projects where you have more, a bit more time for the planning, how you're going to do them. How does it go with events? So spot where you have to be a bit more spontaneous in terms of audio description. I don't know which kinds of events you've worked in, but could you explain a bit more about how your work has made it possible for people to have better access to live events?
Absolutely. Live events are the most exciting and challenging of all forms of accessibility. I do a lot of audio description for live performances, and these range from theatre to music concerts to global events such as football World Cups. As the last one we had in Qatar, or the one the Youth National Day we had in Portugal only last year with Pope Francis. There is a lot that we have to think about. Of course, we always think about anything we offer. We have to guarantee that it is as accessible as possible throughout the journey. But if we are to just focus on the audio description, as an audio describer, I have to be incredibly versatile. Sometimes I'm not given the opportunity even to prepare myself for what I need to audio describe. Let me give you a very concrete example. In the national in the youth the World Youth Day with Pope Francis, we had young people from across the globe, 6 million people on each of the events we had. And we had events that went from mass with the rituals that go with the Catholic mass. We had performances. Live performances with dances and circus, and we had young people just spontaneously breaking into performances among themselves here and there. We had the Pope coming by in the Papa Marvel, the little car that takes him around. At mo certain moments, he would simply stop the procession, talk to people around him, interact with the public. The public would erupt in sing and dance and performance. And as an audio describer, I would be sitting in a little corner with a screen the screen that is provided to all the news agencies. And there I would be having to audio describe all these different events,
Wow.
including those moments that were not scripted at all. The dignitary that has just arrived, the way the Pope has taken a glass of water from somebody who has reached out with that glass of water, a child who has offered a drawing to the Pope. And in split seconds, I have to move into describing a drawing. I have to move into selecting the information that at that particular moment is telling a new story. So it is a communication skill that I have had to develop. Not only will I be preparing scripted audio guides for museums in communication with a curator, nor will I be audio describing a ceremony that is already ritualized, as is mass, nor will it be enough to for me to audio describe a dance performance that has already, or a theatre performance that already has been that has a choreography that has been given to me. As an audio describer, I have to be ready to, on the spot, improvise and to select and describe a particular action that is just taking place. Now, you will be asking me, in what language are you working? There are people from all over the world. How are they receiving your audio description? Are they using their cell phones? Are they using the radio? How will somebody, 6 million people in there, I apologize, not 6 million, there are 60 million. Apologies. How will you get across to all these people? Of course, we had tandem interpreting. I was working into English. I had a colleague working into Portuguese because this was in Portugal. And then we had tandem interpreters taking my audio description into other languages, and people were tuning in to the different pitches that were being distributed and tuning into the different languages of their choosing. So this is a mega event
That's amazing.
where a service had to be prepared beforehand, but in reality, everything could go wrong the moment it goes live. But fortunately, everything can also go right, because not everything was perfect, but everything was honest, and everything was done to the best of everybody's ability.
And I guess it's having the resilience and something like that to think, okay, this isn't going quite as it should, but okay, what do we do? And just being able to keep going and to find a solution, to be creative. Because I think what I'm hearing here from all the things you're talking about is that you have a very interesting life. You're doing all these different kinds of projects, but for people who maybe we'd want to focus on only one. There are roles for anybody who would be interested in working in this field. I'm thinking more of the listeners to the podcast who at the moment are maybe translators or interpreters and who would like to diversify what they're doing. Even if somebody only wants to focus on one of these types of roles, they can do that because you don't have to be in a situation like for somebody who would find, I can think of people who would find this event idea really exciting, and I think of other people who would find that terrifying. But at the same time, if somebody wanted to focus more on content that had already been prepared, then they could do that. You don't have to sign up for all of the activities, but there are certainly different roles that are available, and I think that people maybe aren't necessarily aware of. And so my question would be for people who would like to find out more, or who would like to train to carry out some of these roles, what would be the next step for them? Because I think, having spoken to some of the people in my network, there are people who would like to get involved, but they don't really know where to start. So, what advice would you give to them?
First and foremost, training. And you can be trained, and I'm just focusing on audio description for now, but this applies to subtitling or tactile communication, multi-format books. You can be trained, and there are ample offers across the globe. In the UK, you have UCL. That is providing summer courses, full master degrees on audiovisual translation for access. Barcelona in Spanish, you have the Autònoma of Barcelona that is also providing training. I would suggest people start by looking into the world of audiovisual translation, particularly access to the media. And they start by training, for instance, as audio describers for cinema, or audio describers for theatre, or subtitlers for the cinema, or for surtitlers for live events. And they specialise in these specific areas. As you rightly said, not everybody wants to take this roller coaster ride that I live in, which is incredibly exciting and daunting. I can only afford to do it today because I've been working on this for the last 25 years and I've gained the experience. I started off as a simple audiovisual translator, as I said earlier on. And I acquired skills through courses and then through practice. I usually say in this domain, nobody can teach you anything. You have to learn everything. Because it's about practice, being exposed to different realities and training, training, training. There is a little element that I haven't mentioned yet, and that I think is absolutely essential. You cannot provide a service unless you know your interlocutor really well. If I am not blind, how can I understand blindness? If I am not deaf, how can I understand the needs of my deaf users? Any work in this domain needs close collaboration with the end users. And I can only be the audio describer I am today because I have been working very, very closely with very, very important partners who are deaf, who are blind, who have taught me and spoken up saying, I disagree with you. I do not like what you are doing. This is useless.
Wow.
So my learning journey and what I would suggest that anybody wanting to learn about this, I would suggest they start by making friends, finding, start communicating with people who have specific needs and learn from them. I don't want to do anything for myself. I want to serve others as I communicate with others. So yeah, train. Number one, get be educated. Number two, train. But number zero, first and foremost, learn about your interlocutors. Become part of their communities and understand exactly what they truly need, what they truly want, knowing that there is no unique profile. Every person is a person, whether they have a disability or not. So we always need to take everything with a pinch of salt.
And also you can have completely different experiences. Just as you were talking about that, I was when I was younger, I used to participate in trips that brought together people with a visual impairment and sighted travellers who would describe the experiences and the places that we visited. But I remember it was really interesting talking to one of them, and she said that every day she'd had a different person and how different the experience was for her, even if she was doing similar activities. Somebody wanted to know about the architecture, someone else wanted to know about the fashion, someone else wanted to know about all the animals. That was probably me. Somebody wanted to I don't know, was more interested in food, or others were more interested in shopping. It was the same kind of experience, but you will never get the same answers to that. You can find a consensus maybe about the right way to do things, but you will always have individual perspectives that differ, that could be completely opposite. But that's life, isn't it? Because we're all individuals, we're all different, we all want and need different things. So I think sometimes this idea that there is one right thing to do, one right way to do things, is the most damaging, because that there isn't, because people are so different.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, if people want to find out more about you and what you do, how is the best way to do that? Is it your website? Is it your LinkedIn profile?
I'm not very, very active on social media. I'm too busy doing the actual thing, but absolutely, my website is hopefully accessible, Kirsty. You tell me, were you able to
Yeah, I was
navigate?
saying it.
Good. So you may visit giselianavish.com and find out what I'm up to. I'm always available to support people's initiatives, offer training, help young scholars with their PhD research. So my job is really that of a teacher, that of a supporter of those who want to do well, want to do better. And all I can do is share my knowledge, my experience, so that they can learn for themselves. So yeah, always here to work with others. That's the joy of what I do.
Well, that's really helpful, because I had two. You asked me before we started recording what my goal was with this podcast, what my intention was, and I had two, which was to explain more about what you do, so that people who are listening will understand this area of work, because I think it's a lot of the time people aren't aware of it. If it's something that you don't have personal experience of, then you're not necessarily aware of the challenges that people face in terms of accessibility and what could be done to meet some of those needs. But also for people, because this podcast is about language and about communication, for those who are already in this field and who are looking at ways to learn new skills and maybe become involved in new projects, then you too have some advice and information. So that's really helpful. Thank you for helping me to meet both of those goals, and I really appreciate your time today and sharing your experience and your practical examples and helping us to understand, if we didn't already, why this is so important.
Thank you, Kirsty, for
Thank
the
you very much.
opportunity. It's a huge pleasure to talk to you. Wishing you the very, very best.
You too. Let's stay in touch.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the English with Kirsty podcast. If you have any questions or comments, my email address is kirsty@englishwithkirsty.com, or you can go to www.englishwithkirsty.com/podcast, where you'll find information about the individual episodes.